friends, we invite you to hear this reading from the Hebrew Bible taken from the book of Judges, beginning in the 12th chapter with the first verse. The men of Ephraim were called to arms, and when they crossed to Zaphon and said to Jephthah, "Why did you cross over and fight against the Ammonites and did not call us to go with you? We will burn your house down over you." Jephthah said to them, "My people and I were engaged in conflict with the Ammonites, who oppressed us severely. But when I called you, you did not deliver me from their hand. And when I saw that you would not deliver me, I took my life in my hand and crossed over against the Ammonites, and the Lord gave them into my hand. Why then have you come up to me this day to fight with me?" Then Jephthah gathered up all the men of Gilead and fought with Ephraim. And the men of Gilead defeated Ephraim because they said, "You are fugitives from Ephraim, you Gileadites, in the heart of Ephraim and Manasseh." Then the Gileadites took the fords of the Jordan against the Ephraimites. Whenever one of the fugitives of Ephraim said, "Let me go over," the men of Gilead would say to him, "Are you an Ephraimite?" When he said, "No," they said to him, "Then say Sibboleth." And when he said Sibboleth, for he could not pronounce it right, then they seized him and killed him at the fords of the Jordan. And 42,000 of the Ephraimites fell at that time. Jephthah judged Israel for 6 years. Then Jephthah the Gileadite died and was buried in his town at Gilead. Hear what the Spirit is saying. Thanks be to God.
That is good. That is good. Good morning, Foundry United Methodist Church. I am humbled and honored to be among you this morning. And in my tradition, sometimes we say we are humbled and honored to be among you this morning, and I'm excited to experience what God will do with us and among us this day. I'm deeply grateful for the deep hospitality and welcome that you've showed me and my beloved already. I bring you greetings from my home church, Metropolitan AME, which has already been said is right here in Washington, D.C., really right around the corner, where the Reverend William Lamar IV is the pastor. Please allow me a moment to thank the senior pastor of this house, the Reverend Ginger Gaines Sorelli, and the executive pastor, the Reverend Dawn Hand. I'm grateful for their trust in the Spirit to work in and through me, and I hold seriously that responsibility. I'd like to thank my beloved Scott for coming out with me today. He supports me with the patience of a saint, and I could never do all that I do if it wasn't for him, so I am so very grateful. But most of all, and before I keep going, I'd like to thank God for plucking me out of the muck and the mire and starting me on my way. To God, I give all the glory and the honor and the praise for doing what I could not do for myself, giving me the gift of salvation into eternity, even right now. Would you pray with me? You know we're down here, Lord, waiting on you, waiting on you, waiting on you. You know we're down here, Lord, waiting on you, and we can't do nothing till you come. You know we're down here, Lord, waiting on you, waiting on you. You know we're down here, Lord, waiting on you, yes, yes. You know we're down here, Lord, waiting on you, and we can't do nothing till you come. God of silent tears and weary years, who holds our hands and our hearts when even unborn hope dies, eternal and loving God, we offer you our grief and our anxieties, our joys and our dreams. And because of your faithful character and demands for justice, we feel safe and secure giving you our whole selves to be made whole selves by your sanctifying grace. Open our hearts and our minds and our souls this morning that our spirits may commune with your spirit without hindrance of the preacher, sin, or enemies of the good. May the words of our mouths and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable, holy, worthy, and worth it in your sight, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. In an episode of The West Wing entitled Shibboleth, President Bartlet must decide whether or not a group of Chinese evangelical Christians qualify for sanctuary after traveling in a shipping container to escape religious persecution. The deputy chief of staff tells him that he's heard concerns that sometimes people feign faith in order to qualify for religious asylum and are coached in what to say. He asks the president, "How will you know the difference?" President Bartlet goes on to tell the show's short interpretation of our text this morning, that shibboleth is used as a password for the army to determine the legitimate from the imposter. When the president meets with a representative from the group, he asks him a set of questions. How did you become a Christian? How do you practice? Who's the head of your church? Can you name any of Jesus' apostles? After answering all of his questions, Mr. Jin Hui says, "Mr. President, Christianity is not demonstrated through a recitation of facts. You're seeking evidence of faith, a wholehearted acceptance of God's promise of a better world." At this point, the music begins to swell, and I'm still trying to figure out if I could have answered the questions that the president was asking. When the man offers his final response during the crescendo, "Faith is the true shibboleth. Faith is the true shibboleth." At this point, we don't know how President Bartlett's going to get it done, but we know things are going to be all right because he responds, "Yes, it is. And you, sir, just said the magic word in more ways than one." And in the world of 1990s and early 2000 political dramas with sexist, ethnocentric, and racist problems of their own, it seems like it's all settled. Faith is the true shibboleth. But what the TV show never asks is this: who determines how we define faith? The title of this morning's sermon is A Brand New Shibboleth. A Brand New Shibboleth. I was in Charlottesville last weekend. I had answered the clergy call from Congregate Charlottesville to stand in counter protest against the Unite the Right rally being staged in Emancipation Park. Local organizers had invited the Reverend Sekou, an experienced master activist, to provide training in what Martin Luther King called militant, nonviolent direct action. We were told in our training that Friday it was likely that white supremacists and police would get up in our face and attempt to dictate both our verbal and our bodily responses. We were trained in strategy and tactics with simulations. We were led in meditative centering. And we engaged in resistance-focused worship that steeled our resolve, prepared our hearts for the very real likelihood of arrest or injury the next day. On Saturday, after a sunrise worship service, we were called into a final strategy meeting. It was then we determined our best course of action based on lower than anticipated number of clergy and an even higher expectation of arrest or injury, even including death. As we silently marched toward the park, first two by two, and then eventually linked arm in arm, about 10 clergy wide and about six rows deep, none of us knew exactly what to expect. Now, many of you have seen the violent attacks white supremacists perpetrated against the counter-protesters, and many have seen pictures of the clergy lined up alongside the park singing "This Little Light of Mine," while faux militia with assault rifles kept close watch over us with a tight precision that demonstrated intense training and forethought. What you probably didn't see were the times that, in response to our direct action, the Ku Klux Klan, American Nazis, and white nationalists left the police-barricaded park to perform impromptu marches along the sidewalk between the armed militia and the line of clergy. With hate-filled flags and speech, with helmets and shields, they shouted ideological bile aimed at our humanity based on race, sexuality, and religion. But we expected all that. We had been trained not to respond verbally or physically, but to hold the line and to stay disciplined. What I never expected was the number of domestic terrorists holding what looked like Bibles who shouted things at us like, nice costume, where'd you go to seminary? How many books are in the Bible? How many books are in the Bible? How many books are in the Bible? This all followed by quick-fire questions for us to name or explain certain biblical texts and their connection with our counter-protest. I had expected the intimidation with slurs and hate speech. I had been committed to, even though I couldn't fully be prepared for, the risk of physical harm. But I never could have imagined my deep impulse to answer their questions when they began to demand of me their version of shibboleth. While I managed to remain silent, I recognized my instinct was to defend my own shibboleth. Theirs was verbal and mine was going on in my head, but what I was witnessing was dueling shibboleths. In our text for this morning, the judge Jephthah is ruling over and working to protect Israel, this time not from an external enemy, which is sometimes easier, but an internal enemy, the fellow tribe of Ephraim. As we enter the story, the Ephraimites challenge Jephthah for not inviting them to help fight the Ammonites. Now, commentaries describe Ephraim as a dominant and important northern tribe throughout much of ancient Israel's history. That being so, I imagine them being unaccustomed to not being in charge, not coming up with and being the heroes of the solution, and certainly not being contradicted in their telling of the facts. Perhaps they'd always been in a place of privilege, able to create laws and policies that were just folded into history as if they were objective and equitable, but in reality served only to protect those who looked like them. Perhaps they'd seen how the way that Jephthah ruled allowed for a shift in access to resources and benefits and opportunities, and now to Ephraim, equity felt like oppression. After being confronted, Jephthah challenges Ephraim's account, saying he did, in fact, call them for help, but receiving none, fought the battle without them and won. The Ephraimites cannot handle this. They call the people of Gilead fugitives, which can also be translated as renegades, in today's language, race traitors who have abandoned their own home tribe. The Ephraimites' prior threat to bring fire down on their heads becomes real as the two sides go to war. And this is where our shibboleth comes back into our work today. In the midst of the battle, the warriors of Gilead defeat Ephraim, except for a few who escape and try to return home. When they get to the entry points of the Jordan River, however, the Gilead soldiers stood their ground saying, "Are you an Ephraimite? Prove it. Say shibboleth." But when they tried, it came out differently, and they responded sibboleth and were killed on the spot. Altogether, 42,000 Ephraimites were murdered in war that day. Now, friends, this is a tough text to deal with. I felt bad for our friend who had to come and read the text this morning. It's clear that the lectionary compilers don't even want us to deal with this text because Judges 12 is nowhere in the three-year cycle. This means... that might tell us a lot right there. They're like, don't touch that. This means that large numbers of preachers and congregations that listen to them would never have to wrestle about what it means to fight with one's own people, what it means for the good news to emerge through a story with so many casualties, what it means to define legitimate and imposter, especially as it relates to faith, especially to those of us who believe in inclusion. But there are times when we have to deal with the things we wish we didn't have to deal with, and wishing won't make it so. The U.S. church is in a shibboleth moment. People who have been blessed with greater amounts of melanin have been telling those of us who were racialized as white this for a long, 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 long time. For God's sakes, folks, we have been in a shibboleth moment since Christianity was used as a weapon of physical and cultural genocide against America's indigenous peoples, since it was deputized to enslave Africans and their descendants, and since it was hidden behind to legalize and politify racism. Now, I'm a theologian, so I get to make up words. For those of y'all that don't know, politify is the act of pretending something is polite when it's not. For some of us, Charlottesville has been a time of awakening. For others, Charlottesville has become the tipping point of waiting no longer. For still others, it's just another example, another expression of what has been here all along, simmering but now bubbling over a more public and publicized surface. For all of us, Charlottesville should be a call for the church to step up and declare once and for all in one voice our own shibboleth. That to be a person of faith and a follower of Jesus the Christ, white supremacy will no longer be ignored nor denied, no longer tolerated nor rewarded. We are in the midst of a crisis. It is a crisis of conscience, it is a crisis of morality, and it is a crisis of faith. The time for waiting is over. Our sisters and brothers of color are dying, and the humanity of those of us who are white is dying. And we cannot wait, and God will not wait. Saying Jesus is Lord while at the same time refusing to stand up and speak out against the legalized and racialized reign of terror upon black and brown people in this country is blasphemy. The Jesus who overturned money-changing tables in the sanctuary is waiting for us to overturn all systems of government, justice, policing, schools, communities, and church that will not value black and brown bodies in equal measure to white bodies. And all systems that will not protect the rights of Jews and Muslims, of Baha'i and Hindu, and the wide cacophony of religious people in equal measure to Christians. And all systems that will not protect the humanity of all LGBTQI people in equal measure to cisgendered heterosexual people. Proclaiming Jesus is Lord means something radical. It means we stand for justice, fight for evil, and resist sin always in every place and at all times. For U.S. Christians, this means we must announce in word and sign and deed that white supremacy will no longer be tolerated nor rewarded in any form, in any form, in any form, in any form. To choose Jesus is Lord is to recognize radical racial justice and equity is a holy sacrament, divinely orchestrated to miraculously transfigure our systems of racial hatred into systems of healing and wholeness. For U.S. white Christians to proclaim Jesus is Lord in 2017 is to embrace without reserve our moral obligation to incontrovertibly break the stranglehold white supremacy has on this country, on our churches, and on our souls. This, my friends, is a clarion call for those of us who are people of faith and those of us who follow Jesus as Christ and Lord to declare this day it's time for a brand new shibboleth. A shibboleth that no longer relies on difference of accent to include or exclude people from safety or survival. Rather, a brand new shibboleth that extracts every last drop of white supremacy from our schools, from our economy, from our communities, from our churches, and from every inch of our government. A shibboleth that refuses to allow white supremacists to terrorize by Charlottesville with torches and tear gas while simultaneously refusing to allow white supremacy to reign in our business or our academic or our church meetings through microaggressions and white-splaining. It's time for a brand new shibboleth. A shibboleth that fights for all symbols of the Confederacy, including but not limited to flags and symbols and statues, to be taken down once and for all, while simultaneously refusing the temptation to protect the laws which keep them in place over and above the people who utilize civil disobedience to get them down. It's time for a brand new shibboleth. A shibboleth that empowers people to gather in the thousands to stand with the people in Boston against hate speech, while simultaneously emboldening Christians to, by the thousands, to transfer all of our personal and ecclesial money into black-owned banks and to shift at least 50% of our spending into businesses of color. It's time for a brand new shibboleth. Friends, it's time for a brand new shibboleth, a shibboleth that will dare not shout unity when really what we need is that white people will feel comfortable. A shibboleth that will not pray peace when really what we mean is white people will be the only ones to determine what order looks like. A shibboleth that shall not hide between weak, ineffectual, and unfaithful definitions of love that only serve to protect those of us who are already protected from our responsibility to get involved in tangible and meaningful ways. It's time for a brand new shibboleth. I know this is tough, y'all, but it's time. It's long past time. It is long past time for a shibboleth that believes, like the West Wing writers, that freedom is the glory of God. And like St. Fannie Lou Hamer says, nobody's free until everybody's free. A shibboleth that makes us ruthless. Ruthless in our unwavering commitment and execution to disrupt and dismantle and destroy white supremacy and racism in every one of its forms. A shibboleth that dares not shake its finger at the society out there without a deep critique of the stuff that's going on right in here. A shibboleth that examines its own leadership structure and membership, its decision making and its decision makers, and its own temptation to hoard power for some at the expense of the rest. It's time for a brand new shibboleth. And our tears will not stop us. And our shame will not stop us. And our guilt will not stop us. Nor will we ignore or deny them. Because we belong to a family of faith that believes in the kind of courageous grace that allows us to stare our sin of racism right in the face, repent for it for tangible and meaningful ways, and find our way back to wholeness. Our fear will not stop us. Our internalized oppression will not stop us. And our anger will not stop us. Nor will we ignore it or deny it. Because we belong to a family of faith that believes in the kind of costly grace that was spent by the Son of God's own self in order that those of us who are targeted and most directly affected by the wounds of white supremacy sin would be free and made whole from the inside out. It's time for a brand new shibboleth. We're going to have to embrace a differential ethic. Now, that's different than how we normally think about it. We think, let's all do this together. Let's all make a plan. Let's all do that plan together. Let's divide the work equally. But what a differential ethic does is it rightly places the greatest amount of responsibility and risk upon those of us who are white and benefit from the privileges of white supremacy and racism in all of its forms. A brand new shibboleth requires that those of us who are white go get our cousins. And while we're doing that, to go get our bosses and our grandmothers and our spouses and our neighbors and all the other white folks that will only listen to us. Not because it's more true when we say it, not because it's more powerful when we say it, but because that's the way white supremacy works. A shibboleth that refuses to water down the work that is ahead of us, but will no longer hoist it onto the backs of people of color because those of us who are white refuse to do the work. Friends, it's time for a brand new shibboleth. Whew. This is not an easy text, and it's not easy work. What we are embarking upon is a shibboleth of anti-racism, transforming our thinking and our doing, our ideologies and our actions, our policies and our practices, all focused toward the goal of creating and sustaining and protecting systems of racial justice and equity. Each of us will be required to risk something different. Some of us who are white will have to risk our privileges. Some will have to risk our protection. And some of us will have to risk the stories of I marched with King, or in my case, I marched in Charlottesville, in exchange for what are we doing right now? For some people of color, you will risk being vulnerable to hurt or harm, being scapegoated for bringing the injustice to the forefront, or being misinterpreted that you are selling out. Shibboleth is scary work, especially for those of us that believe that tolerance of different ideas and respect for all human beings is sacred. Declaring our shibboleth defines who we are and inevitably excludes some folks because it creates a line in the sand over which we cannot cross. For those who are worried about or have experienced the harm that comes from being excluded by the church, this is especially terrifying ground. But declaring a shibboleth of anti-racism simply means that we are intolerant of intolerance. In 1945, what is called the paradox of tolerance was written down for the first time publicly and attributed to Karl Popper. Popper stated that while it may seem counterintuitive for tolerance to be intolerant of anything, it's actually just a paradox. This is because the first thing intolerance does is to eradicate tolerance. Thus, tolerance cannot exist if it tolerates intolerance. Now, I'm going to say that again because that was a mouthful. I had to practice that a good couple of times on my own before I even came here with it. So I'm going to say that one more time. While it may seem counterintuitive for tolerance to survive, it must be intolerant of intolerance. This is because the first thing that intolerance does is to eradicate tolerance. Thus, tolerance cannot exist if it tolerates intolerance. Intolerance isn't simply another philosophy or ideology. It's the inability to allow for any other philosophy or ideology to survive in its midst or in its wake. All forms of intolerance will use hatred, fear, violence to indoctrinate their followers and eradicate the rest. This is why white supremacy or racism in any of its forms cannot be reduced to just another option, idea, or preference. What if the only intolerance Christians were known for was the intolerance of intolerance? Now, I'm just going to say one last thing, and then I'm going to take my seat. You may have read in some of the articles about Charlottesville that the clergy line chanted, "Love has, love has, love has already won." Out of context, it sounds like we're blindly believing the whitewashed version of Martin Luther King's quote that hate cannot drive out hate, only love can do that. This version makes it seem like Dr. King is talking about the Hallmark version of love, full of feelings but devoid of commitment, full of dreams but devoid of reality. But in context, it reveals something else. Reverend Sekou led us in this chant when we were surrounded by the taunts and chants of the Klan, American Nazis, and white nationalists. As they marched in front and behind us, and as our heart rates began a double time drumbeat, we were instructed to declare, love has, already won. When the first scrap-ups began between the domestic terrorists and Antifa at one end of our line, we were locked arm in arm, chanting, love has, love has, love has already won, as our only defense. The fluffy bunny pie in the sky Hallmark kind of love doesn't cut it here. This is James Baldwin's love that says, if I love you, I have to make you conscious of the things that you don't see. This is Dr. Cornel West's love that says, justice is what love looks like in public. This is Jesus's love that says, you may be looking at Good Friday or sitting in the deep despair of Holy Saturday, but there is a resurrection coming that you can't yet imagine and you can't create on your own without me. We weren't singing, love has already won, because it had. We were singing it because we believe in a God whose love has conquered even death. The kind of love that stares into the face of structural sin as thousands of Klansmen and women, American Nazis and white nationalists scream back, blood and soil, and you will not replace us. It allows us to sing songs of freedom while held hostage in a church by torch-wielding domestic terrorists who can't stand the idea that God intends for power to be shared and justice to reign. We don't declare a brand new shibboleth because it's already here. We declare a brand new shibboleth because love has already won. Love has already won.